This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. America's great naturalist, John Muir, wrote, "Walk the sequoia woods at any time of the year, and you will say they are the most beautiful on earth." This is what you hear when you walk through those very woods in the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks in California.
The two parks together protect an amazing range of habitats, mainly because of the great elevation that the park spans, which is the largest elevational range of any park in the lower 48.
Christy Brigham is head of resource management and science for the two parks.
From oak woodlands in the foothills, climbing up to mixed conifer, all the way to alpine and glaciers. Both parks are incredibly beautiful, 98% wilderness, very wild, and with some of the largest, oldest trees on the planet.
The park's giant sequoias live on a different timescale than us. The thick, red, ropey bark that twists higher than a 20-story building might have taken more than 2,000 years to reach that high. In comparison, a fast metabolism human lifespan, the duration of but a mere entish inhale and exhale to these magnificent giants. But Christy Brigham says, in that ecologic blink of an eye, human beings have transformed the sequoia's world.
When people think about climate change, they often think about something that will happen a long time in the future. It's not the future, it's here now. The state estimates 5.8 million dead trees. Those trees are dead because of an interaction between 100 years of fire suppression and then a climate change-driven hotter drought. We've seen snow line advance uphill 100 feet. We're seeing some birds nesting 14 days early. We're seeing some of the oldest and most resilient trees on Earth being killed by novel things, a new kind of a cedar bark beetle that's been here forever but has never before been able to kill giant sequoias. Now, because of an interaction of drought, stress, and fire, is able to kill these trees. We're seeing changed fire behavior, way more severe, very high flame lengths, able to kill these trees that are very fire resistant. So we are observing these changes right now in real time. This spring, when I was finally able to, after the snow melted, hike out to Board Camp Grove that was severely burned in the fire and see for myself the huge, hulking, blackened skeletons of these trees that were clearly over 1,000 years old, had been standing there for centuries, withstood lots of previous fire, so resilient, so incredible. And now we have generated a situation that's capable, where fire is capable of killing them. It's very heartbreaking. I think what we're seeing in so many places, and it's true here, is that the consequence of inaction is clearly going to be so much worse. We just lost 10% of the world's giant sequoias in a single wildfire because of inaction, because of our inability to do prescribed burning and mechanical thinning. I have two kids, 16 and 13, and I think about them a lot. And I get letters, these heartbreaking letters from kids and young adults who visited the sequoias and hugged a sequoia and were so moved by that and want their grandkids to be able to have that experience. And when you live with the sequoias and you think about their lifespan, 2,000 years, you do get in that mindset of, what do we need to do now to make sure these trees are here 2,000 years from now? And what does that mean? And that's a burden and an inspiration.
Christy Brigham is the head of resource management and science for Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks in California. Well, let me turn now to Patty Glick. She is senior scientist for climate adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Magna, for having me on.
And John Clayton as well. He's author of Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands, and Wonder Landscape, Yellowstone National Park, and the Evolution of an American Cultural Icon. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Patty, let me ask you, you heard Christy talk about this duality of climate change creating both a burden and an inspiration on how she has to manage the Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. How much is climate change creating that duality across the National Park Service?
Well, yeah, I just first want to say hearing from Christy was really, truly powerful. You know, it's certainly true. National parks across the country no doubt face some very difficult but important decisions about how to tackle the challenges posed by climate change. It's a reality that a lot of people are coming to grips with. Just to share a little bit of background, over the last decade, we at the National Wildlife Federation have been working with a coalition of federal resource management agencies, including the National Park Service, basically to help them figure out how to cope with the impacts of climate change in their work. It's a practice known as climate adaptation. And in the context of natural resource management, we often refer to it as climate smart conservation. But we've also been working with agencies individually to help customize the guidance for their unique needs. And, you know, the National Park Service has actually recognized and been concerned about the effects of climate change for a long time. In fact, the agency made the decision to move the historic lighthouse at North Carolina's Cape Hatteras National Seashore more than 20 years ago because it was vulnerable to sea level rise and erosion. But in recent years, the concern has definitely grown as parks have experienced worsening wildfires and hurricanes and other extreme events, in addition to some of the ongoing changes. And that realization that climate change is having a significant impact on park resources and assets has really compelled the agency, I think, to find ways to reduce the risk in just about all of its work. And so the planning for a change in climate guidance that we help develop is intended to help parks navigate the considerable climate-related challenges that they face across their whole range of activities, from siting visitor centers and other infrastructure and protecting wildlife to ensuring cultural and historic resources still are meaningful. And, you know, just the one thing I would like to notice.
If I could just step in here for a quick second.
Sure.
Because, you know, we have the whole hour to really dive deep into this idea here. And I want to make it clear to listeners that the reason why we're talking to you, Patty, in particular today is because of what you just mentioned, right? That you're one of the lead authors of this relatively new National Park Service report, as you mentioned, called Planning for a Changing Climate. And it's this notion that climate change has become so, unavoidable. You cannot close your eyes to it anywhere. And now the National Park Service itself is really, from what I understand, this document is trying to help provide this toolkit for how the NPS, you know, should go about its core mission in protecting America's most beautiful public lands. And that's what we really want to talk about, how climate change might be changing that mission. But if you could just hang on for a second here, John. Let me just turn back to you. Last time we had you on the show, I had just gotten back from Yellowstone. And this time that we have you on the show, I literally just got back a couple of weeks ago from Zion and Bryce Canyon.
Oh,
so
excellent.
I am an unabashed super fan of America's national parks here. But can you talk to me a little bit about your first thoughts about how climate change might be shifting what is popularly conceived of as the National Park Service's most sacred mission, that preservation of these, you know, spectacular, unique public lands?
Yeah, you know, these landscapes often sort of represent what we love about America, America's best idea, in the words of Wallace Stegner and Ken Burns. And 100, 150 years ago, we collectively decided to set aside these lands to preserve them so that our grandkids could have the same experiences that we did in those places. And so to think about losing them, it feels a little bit like losing, you know, the best of America, if they were to change due to climate or other problems.
So I guess the core question here is in that word, preservation. How did the National Park Service previously define or historically define preservation? And is that still possible with climate change?
One of the interesting things about the period, especially from the 1890s to the 1910s, was that we had different values related to the environment, and we set aside lands for different purposes to meet those different values. The parks were set aside for preservation, to preserve these places untouched, the glory of nature. Meanwhile, the national forests were set aside under a philosophy of conservation. Let's conserve some of these resources for the future. Let's not cut down all of our trees today so that we will have some timber available tomorrow. Conservation implies management. We're going to choose which trees to cut, which valleys to dam. Preservation implies that we can leave nature alone, that humans are separate from nature, and perhaps even worse than nature, and nature will be able to figure these things out on its own. And so I think what we're seeing here is a crisis in which, boy, nature may not be able to figure out climate change.
Well, when we come back, Patty, we're going to talk more about what's in this report that you helped co-author for the National Park Service called Planning for a Changing Climate. But as we head into the break, let's listen to a moment to an early morning bird chorus from Mineral King Valley, recorded at 8,093 feet in the subalpine ecozone of Sequoia National Park. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we are talking about how climate change is having an impact on America's national parks. So much so that recently the NPS put out a report called Planning for a Changing Climate. And it lays out a whole new management scheme and different kinds of decisions that the Park Service will have to make as America's most precious public lands are changing very rapidly due to climate change. I'm joined today by Patty Glick. She's Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation, and she's one of the lead authors on this National Park Service report. She's been studying climate change for 30 years, and she joins us from Bend, Oregon. Shout out to my home state, Patty. And also, John Clayton joins us as well. He's author of Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands. Now, let's listen to a moment to what's happening, for example, in one of the most northern national parks in this country, and that's in Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska. Dave Schurkauer is the science and resources team leader at Denali, one of the largest parks in the system, over 6 million acres. And he says he's seeing climate change in a big way.
Permafrost is a really key driving feature of the landscape. Most of the northern 2 million acres of the park is underlain by ice-rich permafrost. And so just to tell you what that means is permafrost is ground that remains frozen for at least 2 years in a row. It's kind of like a frozen wetland where there's a lot of water content in the soil that's been frozen for millennia in some cases. this permafrost is thawing. So the active layer, that's the layer that melts and freezes seasonally, is getting deeper. So we're getting more active layer and less permafrost. And that has all sorts of implications.
And one of the implications he gave us, for example, is the impact it might have on trumpeter swan habitat.
There are a bunch of lakes out in the northwest corner of the park, hundreds of little lakes. And so trumpeter swans are abundant out there in the summer, and they rely on these lakes. Many of these lakes are permafrost controlled. So what that means is that the water is held in place because of the frozen ground that surrounds them. It would be a big deal to lose a lot of that permafrost because it will cause many of those lakes to disappear. And we've seen some of them disappear already.
And Dave Schurkauer also told us that he is heartened, though, by the new National Park Service guidelines on climate change, because they are providing a new framework for him to think about management in Denali.
It gives us some really good language to put on how we view our response to the changing climate. And there's a mantra that's come out of that, and it's called accept or resist. And there are places where resisting is totally appropriate. And, you know, I think of Sequoia and the fact that those trees were seedlings during the last ice age and the climate was really, really different, and they're fundamental to the park. So yeah, let's resist, because that's a key feature. And in other places, we just accept and observe. And I think because of our large intact landscape, and also that all of our species are here that have been here since, you know, before humans were even part of this landscape, puts us more on the accept or adapt side of that equation.
So that's Dave Schurkauer, science and resources team leader at Denali National Park and Preserve in Alaska. Now, Patty Glick, I wonder if you could just tell us broadly if in the new guidance that you helped co-author here, the Planning for a Changing Climate, if the sort of big picture shift here, or reckoning, as you've been quoted as saying, is what John Clayton was telling us earlier, that the National Park Service now, due to climate change, has to move away from a pure preservation mission and to one of more active management, where the Park Service has to make more and more decisions every year about what to protect, what to conserve. What is the reckoning that's going on here?
Well, you know, I think John is making a very important point. I mean, one thing we do need to acknowledge is that conservation goals are values-based, and the Park Service is going to need to figure out not just what's achievable in terms of its adaptation strategies, but also what's acceptable. But that said, America's conservation vision as a whole has evolved over time. We went from this initial idea of protecting pristine landscapes and, you know, to managing lands and waters for hunting and fishing, to this broader goal of protecting biodiversity. And I think climate adaptation is a continuation of that evolution, including within the Park Service. I think it represents an era of conservation in which we need to embrace decision-making under uncertainty and accept the need for innovation and experimentation. For example, some parks are considering strategies to actually direct change. There's a approach called managed relocation, which essentially takes species that, you know, may no longer persist in their current or historical range because of a change in climate, and actually move them to new areas, hopefully so that they will remain there. And it's somewhat controversial. It needs to be, you know, the parks are definitely looking at the risks of any potential downsides. But for some people, it means the only hope of avoiding extinction.
Well, so this is a really interesting example, right? Because my understanding was that overall, historically, the National Park Service viewed these particular lands as having kind of a pretty tight range of what was considered natural, right? And it sounds as if climate change is pushing those habitats out of that natural historical range, and that's the thing that the National Park Service has to urgently contend with now. Is that right?
Well, that is true. You know, climate change is forcing, as I've mentioned before, a reckoning on what something really means to be natural, especially if you consider that to be a condition reflected by the absence of humans. And I think a really good example of this is how we consider shifts in the range of native species in response to climate change on their own. In the Southwest, for example, places like Bandelier National Monument in New Mexico have seen extensive loss of pinyon, pine, and juniper woodlands due to extreme drought and insect outbreaks. But on other public lands in the West where you know, human-caused climate change is actually contributing to an expansion of such woody vegetation into existing grasslands and sagebrush, you know, managers in those areas are confronted with the question of whether to resist that expansion by removing the plants so that they can, you know, maintain the current habitat, or whether that expansion is a quote-unquote natural change that can be accepted or even facilitated.
John Clayton, what do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a need for the parks to manage these landscapes. You know, I think there's a romantic misinterpretation when we think about preservation and this assumption that the parks will naturally just stay the way they are. Ecosystems do always change, mm-hmm. and in order to manage these spiritual experiences that we can have in great natural environments, we do need to do some management. And the Park Service, frankly, always has done some management. So this is a logical next step.
Well, Patty, very early on in this report, it states that it may not be possible to safeguard all park resources, right, or assets or values in their current form over the long term. I'm wondering if you could give us a couple of more examples from other national parks about the rapid changes they're seeing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the things that comes to a lot of people's minds is, you know, what's going to happen to, you know, the parks whose, you know, namesake features are at risk from a changing climate. I mean, we heard about the glaciers in Glacier National Park, for example, early in the program, and you know, there may no longer have glaciers in that park just within a few decades. And at Joshua Tree National Park in California, we're seeing hotter and drier conditions killing off those species. And it, you know, kind of begs the question, what does this mean for some park's legacy? And we actually joke about this a little bit, about whether we need to call the Joshua Tree National Park the park formerly known as Joshua Tree.
No, go ahead. I'm just kind of reacting, you know, from a very bittersweet, mostly bitter point of view.
From a very bittersweet perspective, yeah. Indeed. I mean, in you know, from a natural resource perspective, I mean, one of the things that the Park Service has long recognized is that ecosystems are dynamic and do change, and that there is a certain amount of adaptive capacity. And in fact, parks are actually starting to work with communities outside of their borders to help increase habitat connectivity so that species that are able to move to track warm, you know, changing conditions are able to do so. But I do think the challenge is particularly great for some of parks that have, you know, historic buildings or, you know, are grounded on cultural resources, that don't have that necessarily that inherent adaptive capacity. And there, you know, unfortunately, I do think that the decisions that parks are going to make are going to be a little bit more binary. You know, let's fight as hard as we can to prevent the loss of these features. But, you know, at some point, yeah, we may have to accept some loss. And it's certainly a big challenge.
Yeah. So a point well taken on the parks that contain culturally important, culturally historic locations that perhaps can be more actively preserved. But about the greater number of acres, the millions of acres that are natural lands, I got to ask you, Patty. I mean, again, maybe I'm just falling prey to the romanticization that does happen with our parks, because as I said, I don't know, I feel like a different person whenever I visit them. But what it seems like this new guidance is suggesting is that, as you're saying, it's not even suggesting, it's providing a framework for how the National Park Service can make decisions to prioritize, even if I can just put it bluntly, on things to save and things to not save, species, landscapes, et cetera. You're talking about perhaps, you know, with the migration of species due to warming latitudes, like how to cope with that. This is all my way of building up to saying another option might have been to say, well, the Park Service should just continue its core mission and try to do nothing, right? Because the change is global, right? So why try to come up with a framework that deliberately introduces far more human decision making and those very values that you were talking about?
Well, again, I do think that the Park Service wants to do everything that it can to ensure that many of the things that people know and love about our national parks, will remain viable, even if they may look different from snapshots of the past. And one other thing I think that is important that will not change about our national parks is their incredibly important role in public education and awareness. And, you know, parks across the country are working to help people better understand the implications of climate change. And I think in doing so, they're actually helping to encourage people to be part of the solutions. And, you know, that not only includes some of the adaptation strategies that's the focus of the guidance, but also strategies to minimize the impacts of climate change through efforts to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, in fact, parks across the country are actually working to reduce their own carbon footprint as a result. And you know, that's a role that they're going to continue to play, and it's a very important one.
John Clayton, let me turn back to you here, because I think it's important to continue to weave into this conversation sort of the historic momentum that the National Park Service has, because I'm reading with great interest, Patty's report, she co-authored it, and the suggestions and the guidance that it offers the modern day National Park Service about, you know, how to triage species and landscapes, like the sort of thinking that park managers will have to go through to decide, you know, which landscapes, which species are worth putting a lot of effort in to save or quote unquote, you know, preserve, how to assess risks when relocating species. Again, as Patty pointed out, that can be pretty controversial, and things like that. And so I just wonder, in a sense, is this actually just an essential continuation of something the Park Service always has done, even though we believed it had this core mission of preserving these natural lands kind of in an unchanging state?
In order to preserve natural lands, we need to use the best available science. And when the Park Service was founded over 100 years ago, we didn't know much about wildlife science. We didn't know how to save species from going extinct. And after great advances in the science of ecology, the Park Service in 1963 asked Starker Leopold, son of the famed ecologist Aldo Leopold, to write a report on how to implement ecosystem management in the parks. That report was really well written, and the land managers found it really useful, which made it really influential in helping to save wildlife species. So when Dave Shirkauer was earlier saying that Patty's report is really useful to him in implementing policies, that I was encouraged that maybe this report can be as valuable as the Leopold report once was.
Well, what do you think? We just have a quick minute to go before our next break here. But Patty mentioned a really important word earlier, and that is values. Do you think conflict or debate over what the guiding values should be as human hands become more prevalent in the management of the National Park Service, do you think that there's going to be more conflict over those values, John?
There's always conflict over values. That's what politics is all about. We just need to make sure that it's informed by great science, like the work that Patty's doing.
Okay. Well, Patty, and I mean, can you just talk with me for a couple seconds more about what you meant about those bringing in those values into thinking about climate change in the Park Service?
Well, you know, absolutely. But, you know, I think it's really important. You know, we did help the Park Service build out this guidance, but it really was a collaborative mm-hmm. effort among many people in the agency who bring their perspectives from their various parks and, you know, are really well grounded in the challenges that they face. You know, and I think it reflects the agency's vision for how it is going to address climate change as part of its mission. And, you know, I think that interpreting some of the changes, helping people, again, understand what they mean is an incredibly important role.
Well, as we head into this next break here, you're hearing wolves howling in Denali National Park and Preserve. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about how climate change is having an impact on America's most precious public lands, and that is our national parks. And the National Park Service recently came out with a report, a new framework, guidance for its managers on how to cope with climate change. The report's called Planning for a Changing Climate. And we're joined today by one of the co-authors of that report, Patty Glick. She's Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation as well. John Clayton is also with us. He's author of Natural Rivals, John Muir, Gifford Pinchot, and the Creation of America's Public Lands and Wonder Landscape, Yellowstone National Park and the Evolution of an American Cultural Icon. And John and Pat, if you can hang on here for just a second, I'd like to now bring into the conversation Abraham Miller Rushing. He's Senior Science Coordinator at Acadia National Park, and he joins us from Bar Harbor, Maine. Dr. Miller Rushing, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on.
So I think one of the most sort of visible ways we're seeing in the impact of climate change and in the national parks is through what's happening to the forests. So can you tell us a little bit about how Acadia's forests have changed over the past decade or two?
Yeah, yes. So first of all, Acadia is tucked away on the coast of Maine. We have dominated by spruce fir forests, boreal forests, and we have rocky coasts, beautiful views. And Acadia is already a really different place than it was 105 years ago. And we can see that through changes in our plants. So about one out of every six of the native plant species that were here 100 years ago are no longer occur in the park. The bird community has changed. We've lost species like boreal chickadee, which used to breed in the park, and now we have species from the south that are coming in, things like turkey vultures and cardinals. And we have bigger storms. And just yesterday, we had 4 inches of rain that fell in about 6 hours and led to a lot of washouts, washed out some of our historic carriage roads and other roads. And unfortunately, these things are becoming more frequent, and the pace of change is really speeding up. And it presents a lot of challenges for how we manage these resources.
So the movement of basically common territories of certain species here, I'm hearing you describe that that's evident in Acadia I'm going to keep my fingers crossed that your line holds up on us, Abe, because there's some important insight that I would like you to bring to this hour. And for example, you've previously talked about invasive species, plant species that are really changing some of the forest in Acadia. And if you can hear me, Abe, I was wondering if you could tell us a story about invasive brambles there.
Yeah. Yes. Sorry about that. Okay. Yes. So what we've been seeing is, so one of the things that we're really concerned about is that we have, so most of the forest here is spruce fir. So about 40% of our trees are red spruce, and we're at the southern edge of their range, and they're very drought intolerant. And so what we're concerned about is that over the next 80 years or so, we anticipate that those species, those spruce trees, are going to decline and disappear. And so that leaves us with what comes next after that. And what we're very concerned about is we have a lot of invasive species like glossy buckthorn and other shrubs that are coming in on their own. And we're concerned that they may come in and choke out the forest and prevent native species from coming in from the south, which we would think would be the normal natural transition with the climate. And so we're thinking about how do we manage that? So how do we keep these invasive species at bay? And do we need to help those species from the south come up?
So this is really, really interesting. Let me just ask you about this. So this is a perfect example of one of those kind of decisions that Patty was talking about earlier, that managers in almost every national park in this country are going to have to, you know, think through. So tell me, how are you thinking through that? Because, you know, the big picture here is the climate is changing. Those species are moving. The invasives are coming further and further north every year. I mean, there's always the do-nothing option. Or there's what, as far as I understand, Acadia has done historically, which is send teams out to sort of rip some of those invasive brambles out. But is that even going to be adequate over the next decade or so?
Yeah, that's our big question. And I mean, it comes back to something that you asked, or that Christy mentioned in the opening, mm-hmm. About at Sequoia and Kings Canyon, that inaction really is a decision. And the inaction can lead to things that we think are unacceptable. And so here we think that inaction is going to lead to invasive species choking out our forests. And so what we're trying to do is really aggressively remove those invasive species to buy us some time to be able to do the science about and investigate how we can responsibly manage that transition to native species from the south. And so we're doing a lot of experiments to try to see how we can responsibly do that. What species survive? What species might look like they themselves might behave invasively when they get here? And what techniques can we use? So there's a lot of science that we're trying to do, and we're trying to buy ourselves some time because we know that we're not going to be able to keep the invasives at bay forever.
How long have you worked at Acadia?
I've been here for 11 years.
11 years. Okay. I understand that. So the pace of change there for certain species is so rapid that for an invasive insect, for example, has really attacked the red pine in Acadia National Park. And according to one article I'm seeing here, is that it could wipe the red pine has virtually been wiped out in just 6 years?
Yeah, yes. Our red pines, over the last 6 years, the red pine scale, which is invasive from East Asia, and it arrived and really very quickly killed all of the red pines in the park. And so there's really no red pines alive in the park anymore. And, you know, this is kind of an example of the pace of change. You know, a lot of models show that species range will shift over times, and our models are looking at 80 years out. But it could happen that the change happens very quickly. So right now our spruces are doing great, but it could happen that they decline very quickly, like over a time period of 6 years, like the red pine we saw.
So I have to ask, I mean, how does it feel to you, Abe, walking through the paths in the forests of Acadia National Park over these 11 years, and now over the past couple of years, seeing, you know, species get wiped out in the blink of an eye, practically, and knowing that making the kind of decisions that you were talking about are going to be an ever more urgent part of your job. I mean, how does that feel, having witnessed so much change so quickly?
Well, I mean, there's definitely a sense of loss for sure. I grew up falling in love with national parks and natural areas. And during my conservation training, we were really taught about restoring things to historic conditions. And now really recognizing that that's impossible and that, you know, my kids and grandkids are going to experience different conditions than what I'm, you know, what I love about Acadia. But there's also a sense of agency and urgency, I think, that that we have the ability to take actions and that we really need to take actions right now to make sure that our forests remain healthy and that even if they look different. So the postcards right now actually look about the same as they did 100 years ago. And 100 years on, they'll look very different. And even though they look different, we can still make sure that they're as healthy as possible.
Mm. Well, John and Patty, I appreciate your patience in listening to Abe talk about his work and the changes at Acadia National Park. But Patty, let me turn back to you. What are you hearing in Abe's experiences there?
Well, you know, thank you, Abe. I really appreciate having your perspective there on the ground. And I think that, you know, Acadia really has been doing some incredibly innovative work in thinking about how to address the challenges that they're facing. You know, I think one thing that's particularly important about the Park Service's adaptation work on a whole is that the agency, you know, they readily acknowledge that there are inherent uncertainties in climate change over time and the potential for surprises, like he mentioned, the potential that they could have a rapid die-off event. And, you know, one thing I think that park planners and managers are being encouraged to do is consider multiple plausible future conditions, from the best case scenarios to the worst case scenarios to everything in between, because hopefully that's going to help them identify management strategies that may be robust no matter what changes may occur.
Hmm. Well, Abe, I'm also curious about, again, if you could just take a minute to explain to us in a little bit more detail some of the decisions that you're having to make or thinking through about how to make regarding preservation of species, that you were are you going to try to bring certain species into the park or not? Help me understand that a little bit.
Yeah. So right now we're essentially following the framework that that the report that Patty worked on set out, the kind of deciding where do we resist change. So there are places in the park, for example, we have some summits and along our coastal areas that are likely provide refugia where climate conditions will change more slowly than others, and we can protect those and try to preserve what's there right now. And there are other places where change is happening more rapidly. And in those areas, we may take a more hands-on directing approach, thinking about how do we make sure that they don't become invasive species thickets. And so we're setting up, we're working with partners, and I should say that all of this work is very key with partners, like the National Wildlife Federation at the national level, but also locally, like with Skudik Institute or Friends of Acadia. All of this requires a lot of partners. But we're setting up experiments that allow us to, where we're bringing in species in kind of raised beds and seeing how they grow alongside of our native species, seeing how some of our small mammals respond to eating their seeds or other things, and uh-huh. trying to get an idea of how the ecosystem might play out if we were to move these species. So we haven't made these management decisions, but we're trying to do the science so that we're smart about it when we do the decisions.
Right. So the idea of bringing in species, though, I mean, Abe, you were quoted elsewhere as saying that, for example, in your training to do this work for in the National Park Service, that in the past, the training was essentially focused on keeping things like they were, right? That preservation notion that we keep coming back to. And folks weren't being trained on how to manage for change. But it sounds like managing for change is the core of the work now. Even just the notion of bringing in species into the park is completely different than preserving things as they were in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a big part of that is it comes back to these conversations about like values and things too. We're having to, well, one, all the people in the conservation field, you know, the vast majority of us have not been trained in how to do this. And so we're learning on the job. And we're having to really think about how our values shift too. And we're having to really have a lot of conversations, like Patty was mentioning earlier, with our stakeholders and with local communities about what are the things that we really value and want to keep the same, and what are the things that we're okay changing and letting change, and how do we want that change to play out? And so it requires a lot of conversations and a lot of soul searching for how we want, you know, the future of national parks to be.
Well, Abraham Miller Rushing is the science coordinator at Acadia National Park. He joined us today from Bar Harbor, Maine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patty Glick, now it's time to, in a minute here, I want to talk about politics and policy and resources. Does the National Park Service, in your view, have the resources it needs to really to effectively do this new and different kind of management of the lands under its care?
Well, you know, I certainly can't speak specifically to what their particular needs are, but I can say more generally that, yes, we are going to need to make investments across the board here to ensure that our federal agencies, our states and local communities have the resources necessary to invest in strategies that help keep both our natural world and our human communities protected and safe as we face these changing climatic conditions. And, you know, and I think that there is, a good vision within the current administration to help make that come to fruition.
Well, Patty Glick is Senior Scientist for Climate Adaptation at the National Wildlife Federation and one of the lead authors on this really interesting and important National Park Service report called Planning for a Changing Climate. Patty, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's really my pleasure.
So, John Clayton, we've got about a minute left here, and I keep coming back to this idea that now what our values are going to strongly determine how America's national parks are more actively managed every year as time goes on because of climate change. And I just wonder if you could, I'm dying to know. I keep thinking about the founding of our parks or the creation of the idea that these places should even be preserved. So I want to ask you, what do you think John Muir would ask us to do now?
It's difficult to know what Muir would say today because he lived in a different era, as the controversy over his racial views should remind us.
Right.
And of course, he said many different things. Like any great prophet, he can be interpreted in multiple ways. But I think what Muir really wanted at the core was for us to acknowledge and celebrate that some places are special and some places have these great spiritual values beyond the monetary values that we often assign to them. So to the extent that we can try to manage these places for those spiritual values, I think he would approve.
I'm going to steal a quote from your book where Muir talks about the part and parcel of the eternal conflict between right and wrong, right?
Right. And then he was just, later in that same article, he said what he wanted was common sense management.
And now we are dealing with common sense management of our national parks in an era of climate change. So, John Clayton, author of Natural Rivals, thank you so much for joining us today.
What a pleasure, as always. Thank you.
And by the way, so many of the natural sounds you've heard this hour came to us from the National Park Service. We have a link to their recordings at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.